You're listening to TalkZone.com, Internet Talk Radio.
TalkZone.com.
Now, TalkZone presents The Bob Woodson Show, What Works and Why, insights and solutions to some of America's most troubling societal problems. Featuring community activist Robert L. Woodson Sr., who has spent decades promoting solutions to some of the most challenging problems facing our nation today. Now, here's your host, Bob Woodson.
Welcome, everyone. This is Bob Woodson, and we're pleased that you're joining us today for The Bob Woodson Show, What Works and Why. Today we're going to focus on black history and some of the untold stories and some of the perspectives on the subject that one doesn't usually hear. And our special guest today is Dr. Bernard Gant, who is the Director of Urban School Services at the Association of Christian Schools International. Bernard, rather than me reading your resume, would you share with our listeners something of your background and your interest in and involvement in this subject?
Okay. Yes, you're correct. I'm the director of the Urban School Services with the Association of Christian Schools International, ACSI, which is the largest association of Protestant Christian schools in the world. And I am responsible for the member schools that target and serve urban students, mostly minority, low-income, and at-risk student populations. And I have been a student of history from that particular standpoint because I believe that historically for African Americans and depressed people, that an education has represented the greatest promise of a better, brighter tomorrow. And I have thought to look at the history of African-Americans, particularly in this nation, from that particular standpoint. And so it has made me somewhat of an avid student of African-American history.
And you've been quite an activist, too, a thinker and an author as well on the subject. I know that I have relied on you to give me some facts and information that one doesn't usually find. And tell us about the range of students that you serve. What is which population of students? And I noticed it's the Director of Urban Services Association of Christian Schools. What role does the Christian faith have in addressing this problem of education?
We target and serve, as I've said, that student population that is greatest at risk in our society, both academically and educationally. I am absolutely convinced that as a nation where we fail to educate, we have to be prepared to incarcerate, because where there are limited positive options of which an education, a quality education, an effective education provides, where there are limited quality options, negative options will present themselves and prevail. And so our schools, there are about 330 schools under the auspices of my department, and these schools are serving roughly 43,000 students throughout the U.S. who are mostly students of color, mostly low income, of what we call under-resourced student population. And these are the children who are most educationally vulnerable. That is, at risk of not making it academically in our society.
And how do we get into this mess that we're in now? I know that in the black community, a lot of people look at the conditions, the high out of wedlock birth. In Washington, D.C., we lead the nation in per capita expenditure on public education, something like $13,000 or $14,000 per capita, and yet we are 48th in outcomes for children. And the fact is that last year there were 12 or 13 elementary school children that attempted suicide. And half of our children drop out before graduating, right. And the large percentage of those who do graduate have difficulty reading their diplomas.
Right.
This condition did not always exist in America. One looks at our current situation and assumes that these are just conditions. But I don't recall looking back historically that this was true. This is a recent phenomenon, is it not?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, because historically, we have always valued an education and perceived that an education was the way out. It was a way to a better life. For example, I was born in public housing in the South. And my mother, who was the daughter of a sharecropper, was only afforded an eighth grade education living in central Alabama. And yet, being a product of public housing, growing up there, my mother placed all of us, all of her boys, her five boys, in a Lutheran school, Faith Lutheran Academy in Mobile, Alabama at the time. And the reason she did that was because the one public school that we could attend in the South, she stated, was in such deplorable condition. She was determined that we would get a good education because she believed two things, that an education was the way out of the project. And she would make the statement, Bob, I'll never forget it. She said, none of my boys are going to grow up to be ditch diggers. You're going to get an education. And so here we are, a family in poverty, in public housing, with an undereducated mother. And yet she was so determined that we would get an education. I'm talking about back in the 50s now, in the 1950s. She was so determined that we would get a quality education that she made the sacrifices, even living in public housing. And sure enough, all of her boys, like myself, went on to college and into a better way of life. And so you're absolutely right. This is a fairly new phenomenon where we have the education opportunities that are available to us today are just not being taken advantage of. And we have a whole genre of parents now who are allowing their circumstances or who have so devalued what an education can do for their children, that I believe is a major contributing factor to the crisis that we're witnessing in public education today. That's putting these children at risk. That's putting our nation at risk.
And yet, when you look at what are the major reform efforts that are being employed to address these problems, they seem to emphasize structure, teaching, improving teacher instruction, better training for administrators. The Gates Foundation has spent millions going into a large public school and saying, well, the answer is to subdivide these large complex into three and four subsets. Let's create science labs on the top floor, and let's put other kind of, and millions and millions of dollars are invested in these kind of structural changes. But not a single dollar invested in trying to develop means of inspiring parents to be better parents the way your mother was inspired. She didn't have probably money to stock a library in your home, right?
Yeah, I asked her, Bob, that question because I was so surprised when it finally dawned on me as I was working on my doctoral dissertation. On the history of faith-based education in the African-American community. And it dawned on me, hey, I was a product of a faith-based education. And I called her about it, and I asked her, why does she do it? The explanation that I've already given. But Bob, when I asked her, I said, but we were living in the project, public housing. I said, didn't it cost you? And the next statement my mother made caused me to choke up. And it is when I dedicated my life to this particular cause. My mother said, oh, yes, it costs me. She said, why do you think I was going to leaving the house every day to go clean other people's houses? She said, I was determined that you were going to get a good education, and I was going to do whatever it took. And that is the reason today why I am such a profound believer in educational freedom, because that's exactly what she did. When the current system to which I was assigned was not working, even in the eyes of a mother who had not even been afforded a quality education herself, when she saw that that system was not working for her children, she chose a school, a system, if you will, that she felt was in the best interest of her boys. And it's the reason why I believe in it, live by it today. I believe that one of the going forward, and I'm a proponent of what I call educational freedom. And I could see the parallels in what happens when a people is not free to exercise and exercise rights that are in their best interest. I see a system today where the people who are the keepers of a system, much like the peculiar system of slavery, who, while enjoying their freedoms, deny freedom to others. And the reason that they deny those same freedoms, and the freedoms that they deny to others, are they deny them to the poor and the powerless. And they deny those freedoms because they maintain that if we set you free, then it will hurt the system. See, that was the argument. That was the argument of the slaveholders. That was the argument. That was the underlying foundational argument for maintaining slavery in this nation.
Because, and then how? Then, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Because they claim that if they set the slaves free, it would hurt the political and economic system of the South. And so look at the hypocrisy of it. The very people who were ready to die for their freedom, who would stand and proclaim it's liberty or death for me, denied the freedoms to others, not because it was in the interest of the others, but because they were committed to maintaining a system from which they benefited.
Well, then there seems to be a contradiction then, because if you look at the people who are standing in the way of giving poor people choices.
Exactly.
They are not all white. In the city of Washington, we have had thousands of low-income kids who were given a voucher to go to a school of their choice, and many of them opted to go to Catholic schools. And in fact, I always joke that 80% of the Catholic schools, 80% are Black Baptists who have to pretend to be Catholic to get a decent education.
Right. Right.
And yet it is the many of the Black political leaders, not all of them, who are standing in the way of the exercise of this choice. Eleanor Holmes Norton, Jesse Jackson, many of them, all of their children were educated in private schools in Washington, but they deny and stand in the way of low-income kids getting the same education.
Well, see, today is not a racial phenomenon. It's one in which there are those who want to maintain a system, a peculiar system, simply because they benefit from the system. And so today it has little, if anything, to do with race. And that is the essence of the hypocrisy of this thing. It's just like the hypocrisy of slavery. And it continues to be kind of a black eye on the nation, because it denies the very freedom to a disenfranchised people that the people denying the freedom enjoy and would never surrender.
You know, this is leads me to go back to Dr. King, because as we approach Black History Month, of course, people are going to be quoting him, and they're just going to be quoting the "I Had a Dream" speech. But what people fail to understand is that King was a person who would be saying the kind of things you're saying. He was always challenging the consensus of the majority. He was always challenging conventional wisdom. He was willing to challenge his own peers, his own fellow civil rights leaders on issues of moral clarity and policy. I think it was Dr. King said that the highest form of maturity of any people is the ability to be self-critical.
Exactly.
Where are the voices of self-criticism today within the Black community?
Well, they're there, Bob, but they just don't get publicized. I hear them. I hear that kind of critical self-analysis that Dr. King called for. I hear him challenging the haves to quote, rise up from their stools of indifference and to bring their resources to bear upon the have-nots. I hear him advocating a strong self-help. And I think it is the what he turned to shortly before his death, when he realized that we can't put ourselves in a state of perpetual dependency, waiting for others to come to our rescue when we have the means. Because you understand, the civil rights movement started out as a movement of the middle class, led by the middle class. Dr. King, Annie Young, Ralph Abernathy, these leaders that we know of the civil rights movement were middle class blacks. And what they were advocating for was for the removal of the barriers that were standing in the way for black advancement. But they were looking at it from the standpoint of not poor blacks. It did not, the movement did not start focusing on the poor blacks until the last quarter of Dr. King's life. And that's when they were in the process of developing the Poor People's March.
When we return, we're going to continue this this discussion. We are talking about some of the lesser known stories in the history of black community. Our guest has been Dr. Bernard Gant, Director of Urban School Services at the Association of Christian Schools International. I'm Bob Woodson, President of the Center for Neighborhood Enterprise, and we will return right after these messages.